Because this is a Blackboard talk, so feel free to come and sit in the front. And second, if anybody from the Emergence Conference left jackets, books, papers, wallets, passports, etc., in the room where we were, please go back, go up and get them, because the other conference is about to go into that room. Yes, and nobody left anything. Okay? Or anybody who left anything is not here. Okay, we have some more people drifting in. Okay, so this is the first Perimeter Wilfrid Laurier Colloquium, the first of what will be a regular event. And so we welcome our friends from Wilfrid Laurier and other places. This is also the last talk of the day in a workshop that's going on the emergence of space-time, in which we've heard about the idea that space-time may emerge from a quantum system, more fundamental quantum system, from a number of points of view. And there is no better way to end that discussion than with the talk of Seth Lloyd. And since this is a bit more of a formal event, you have to suffer an introduction a bit more. And it's very nice to have Seth here. Seth personifies some of what this institute is supposed to be about. I didn't know till I looked you up that you're a professor of mechanical engineering with quantum mechanical engineering, but Seth is the kind of person who could easily fit in four or five different departments in the university. Seth started off, did an undergraduate degree at Harvard, then went to England, where he did both part three of physics, math, and a philosophy degree, if I understand correctly. And then he went to Rockefeller University, where he did a degree which I guess was physics, under Heinz Pagels, who some of us remember very, very fondly. And Rockefeller University took very, very few students. And after a certain number of physics students, they decided never to take any more, to my knowledge.
I was one of the last.
Yes.
Causality, or no, never mind.
So Seth may have had something to do with that. And he has been a very important creative and very important seminal contributor to information theory, quantum information theory, and now the physics of space-time, and we look forward to hearing his talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lee. So when I was invited to give this Laurier Perimeter lecture, my instructions were to come up with something fun for mathematical physicists. And then I was happened to be giving a talk here at the same time, and Lee and Roderick Melnick asked me if I could combine the two talks. So something fun for mathematical physicists and something about the emergence of classicality and quantum gravity. Now, this is kind of a tall order. So I'm going to aim for something, first something practical, and then something mathematical, and I'm going to finish with something extreme, like something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. However, I suspect that this won't work very well, and the probable effect will be for me to annoy everybody as much as possible, which in itself is a desirable thing. I feel, you know, Newton said, if I've seen further than others, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants, and I've heard it said by one not to be named Nobel laureate, if I've seen further than others, it's because I was peering over the shoulders of dwarfs. And I would like to say about myself, if I have flown further than others, it's because I trod on the feet of giants. Okay, so, what, wasn't funny? Oh no, never mind. Oh well, okay, good. So the title of this talk is Computing the Universe. And there are going to be two parts to this. In the first part, I'm going to tell you about something that's actually rather practical, which is how you use a quantum computer to simulate other quantum mechanical systems. And of course, what better system to simulate than the universe itself? So we'll talk about how hard it is to simulate the universe. And then for the second part of the talk, I'll say, well, if we can compute the universe on a quantum computer, right? So if we can compute its behavior, who's not to say that the universe is itself some kind of quantum information processing system? And perhaps we can get information about quantum gravity by looking at how information is processed at the most microscopic scale in the universe. So the second part of the talk, which is the part for the emergence workshop, is how do you construct a theory of quantum gravity based on quantum computation? All right? And I hope that these will go reasonably well with each other. So are there any questions about that? What's going to happen? OK, and I have an hour. Is that correct? OK, good. OK, so if you like, the first part of this talk is really about Laplace's demon. The Marquis Simon de Laplace, back at the very end of the 18th century, proposed the idea of, well, let me not say what he proposed. Let me just read what he said, translated into English. "We may regard the present state of the universe as the effect of its past and the cause of its future. An intellect which at any given moment knew all the forces that animate nature and the mutual positions of the beings that compose it, if this intellect were vast enough to submit the data to analysis, could condense into a single formula the movement of the greatest bodies of the universe and that of the lightest atom. For such an intellect, nothing could be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes." Laplace didn't call this being a demon. Other people called it a demon. Everybody had demons back in those days. You know, Maxwell's demon, Loschmidt's demon, etc. So Laplace had to have a demon as well. I mean, I rather think he thought of this more as a kind of divine kind of being. But remember, he said it has a vast intellect, if its intellect were vast enough. So you can regard the first part of this talk, first half, as a calculation of just how vast that intellect would have to be. How smart would Laplace's demon have to be? And then what would Laplace's demon have to do in order to recreate the dynamics of the universe as a whole? All right? OK. So first, let me give a little talk, a review of what quantum computation is. Oh, and by the way, so the first part of this talk, if you're interested in some more of the technical details, you can find it in the first two of these articles here, together with references therein. The second part corresponds to this third article right there. So what is a quantum computer? Well, a quantum computer is one that is a device for processing information at the quantum mechanical level. Now, of course, you know, an ordinary computer, like the ones that I see in this audience, of course, they abide by the laws of quantum mechanics, and they process information as well in our quantum mechanical systems. But a quantum computer is a device that operates on individual quanta. So it stores bits, for instance, on the spins of electrons or the polarizations of photons, so that photon waving like this is 0, photon waving like this is 1. Okay? So, and the way that a quantum computer works is rather the way that a classical computer works on classical bits. A quantum computer takes a couple of bits at a time, and let me draw a couple of quantum bits here. It applies to it some unitary transformation. It sends them off, and then you can take in some other quantum bit. And then at the end, you can compare this to another set of quantum bits. That's basically all that it is. And in this picture, time goes up. I know that, as I mentioned when I was here last time, you know, normally for engineers, even quantum mechanical engineers, time goes from left to right. Okay, and from physicists, time goes from right to left. Okay. To resolve this problem here, we're going to have time go from bottom to top, which is what people in general relativity do, which is, I've always thought, the best way, because it's, you know, it's hopeful. You know, things could be getting better, right? It's growing like a tree. So when I draw a picture like this, this is to be understood as I have some input state in some particular set of states. These are all zero. If you like, they could be all photons, three photons that look like this, wiggling like this. And then I apply some set of transformations that, say, act on these quantum degrees of freedom in a pairwise way. And then at the end, I compare it to some final state. And this gives me a quantum mechanical amplitude, a complex number. And alpha squared is equal to the probability. It's a probability of starting in the state 0, 0, if you start in the state 0, 0, 0, and then transform these bits by these simple pairwise interactions. At the end, are you in the state 0, 0, 0? Okay? And every quantum computation can be phrased in this form. You don't necessarily have to have 0, 0, 0 here. You could have anything that you want. It doesn't really matter. But that, at bottom, is what a quantum computation is. It's something that constructs an amplitude for certain things happening to information at the most microscopic scale. All right? Everybody happy with what a quantum computation is? But who here has not taken quantum mechanics? OK, who here has taken quantum mechanics? All right, OK. Sorry for you people who have not taken quantum mechanics. I just want to know how much quantum mechanics I've got to tell in the course of this talk. But don't worry, you are not forgotten. All right? OK. So for example, here's a nice good example of a quantum logic gate. So this is the initial state. These are the effects of quantum logic gates. And this is the final state. And the overall thing is an amplitude. And the amplitude tells you about probability of something happening. For example, we could have one of my unitary transformation, U, could be something like this, e to the minus I s theta, where s is equal to sigma x on the first qubit with sigma x on the second qubit, sigma y plus sigma z. In other words, it's equal to the projector onto the triplet space for two qubits. It's the Heisenberg interaction between two spins. This is a kind of interaction that takes place quite naturally. If you take, for instance, two electrons, okay, in two quantum dots next door to each other, and you allow them to interact with each other. They interact very naturally according to this Heisenberg interaction. So these, you can think of these U's as being transformations that are already found in nature, which we're going to exploit to do computation. Okay? That's a good example for this, and I can write this out. I'm going to need this in the future. So if I write this out, one other nice way of writing this out is I'm having trouble with this junction of the boards here. If I'm in the so-called singlet state, which is 1 minus the triplet state, then nothing happens to me, okay? Whereas if I'm in the triplet state, then I get a phase of e to the minus I theta. You can think of this as being like a Hamiltonian for a physical system in which the triplet state has energy 1, and the singlet state has energy 0, all right? OK, now, it's a fact that any unitary transformation on n degrees of freedom can be approximated arbitrarily closely by a quantum computation to within epsilon by a quantum computation. That is to say, quantum computers are universal for they're universal systems for discrete quantum mechanics. For discrete quantum mechanics. By discrete quantum mechanics, I simply mean quantum systems for finite dimensional quantum mechanical system. So any finite dimensional quantum mechanical system, say made up of a finite number of quantum degrees of freedom, can be approximated. Its dynamics can be approximated arbitrarily closely by a quantum computation. And I'll prove this to you, OK? So let me show you why this is true. So is everybody happy with this statement right here? This is not actually this is not a controversial statement or anything like that. A lot of this right here is going to be review. In fact, this is all review on this board right here, and this will also be review as well. And then we'll scoot on into how hard is it to simulate the universe. Well, you know what? Yeah, let me just do that. So for instance, let me show why this is true, and I'll just give it by an example. Suppose that I only have two transformations, which I'll call U0 and U1, that I'm applying on this system. Okay? Say it's some system like a set of spins. It's got some natural Hamiltonian. And I'm just twiddling a couple of these spins, flipping them back and forth, using nuclear magnetic resonance, very well-developed quantum technology, to address a couple of these spins. What that means is that basically I can apply, say, let's just say it's one of these spins, two transformations, spin up or spin down. So I have the spin, I put it spin up, I let things evolve, spin down, I let things evolve. Now my claim is this allows me to construct any possible unitary transformation. Why is that? I can do things like, oh, first I do U0, and then I do U0 again, and then I do U1, and then I do U0, U1, U1, U0, etc. And so you see, I basically have, after n times, I have 2 to the n, or sorry, m times, I have 2 to the m possible transformations. Right? On this finite dimensional vector space. Typically, as long as there's no symmetry that relates U0 and U1, these transformations are spread virtually approximately uniformly over the set of all possible transformations. Okay? And that means if I have n degrees of freedom, let's say they're n qubits, so 2 to the n states, then when m is greater than 2 to the 2n log of 1 over epsilon, I can approximate I can get within, sorry, I broke my chalk, now I can't write, with an epsilon of any u. This is a sketch of the proof of why quantum computation is universal. If I have a finite dimensional space, and I can just do a few simple things on here, then because after a long time, there are lots and lots of different possible things, different possible transformations I could build up by programming the system properly, that is by selecting this proper set of inputs here, I can, as time goes on, get arbitrarily close to any desired transformation. Okay? So it's a sketch. It's an example, but it's a sketch of why this is true. So everybody happy with that? Okay. People are looking at me. They're not expressed looking at me in a happy fashion. But some people are nodding their heads ever so slightly, and so I'll take that as a yes. Okay. Now, this in of itself, so this proof of universality doesn't mean that quantum computers are necessarily useful, right? It might be very, 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 very hard to do anything fun at all with these kinds of systems. But in fact, there are all sorts of fun things that you can do with quantum computers. I guess the killer app for quantum computers, the most famous application, is factoring large numbers to break public key cryptography and strike fear in the heart of the National Security Administration. Which, by the way, is since the National Security Administration, NSA, is one of the biggest funders of quantum computation. Why? Because they don't want quantum computers to exist, because it would put them in trouble. But if they can exist, they want to have the first one. All right. But because they don't want them to exist, they're excellent funders. You know, you go to them, you say, well, we tried really, really hard, and we were really unable to build a quantum computer. And they say, great, great, great. Here's another $1 million, right? We should all have funding like that. OK. let me give an example, a brief example, of a very useful kind of quantum computation. which if you can do it, which is in fact the probably the use of quantum computation which is going to be the most commercially viable soon, okay? Because it doesn't require a quantum computer with tens of thousands of bits. It requires only a quantum computer with a few tens of bits, which is good because, you know, we can already build a quantum computer with 10 to 12 or 15 bits, and in the near future, we're likely to be able to, and with Raymond Laflamme here, can he wave his hand? Yes, there he is. He's likely to be able to be building quantum computers with 20 or 30 quantum bits in the not so distant future. Here's a very good thing to do with it. And this, of course, is where Laplace's demon comes in. Back in 1982, Richard Feynman, who was one of the founders of field quantum computation, he wrote only two papers, this is one of them, pointed out that if you just had quantum analog computers, or these quantum devices, some kind of quantum device that I'll describe in just a second, it would make the life of physicists much easier. You know, physicists, as you probably know, if you've ever had any supercomputer time, are great hogs of supercomputer time. They burn up vast quantities of teraflops in simulating what happens when just a couple of little quarks collide with each other. You know, how profligate. Why couldn't they make that a lot easier? Well, the problem is that calculating what happens when there's just a couple of quarks collide with each other is actually pretty darn hard. They live in a very large dimensional vector space, right? The Hilbert space for them is huge. And the transformations are these 2 to the n by 2 to the n transformations. You have to integrate these large Hamiltonians. It's awful, okay? However, if you had what Feynman pointed out is if you just had a very small quantum system, like a bunch of spins, and you could design its Hamiltonian, right? If you were able to construct designer Hamiltonians, Ralph Lauren Hamiltonians, right? Or my Japanese designer jeans, which are called Edwins, okay? Very cool, right? Don't you wish you had Edwin genes? No, sorry. If you could just design these Hamiltonians, then you could solve all these problems. So a quantum computer with a few tens of quantum bits would be as powerful as the most powerful supercomputer. Why? Well, let me show you how to do this. So in 1996, that's the science paper right there from 1996, I showed how you could do this with a quantum computer. Suppose you have a Hamiltonian, and it's equal to the sum of terms that operate on a few degrees of freedom, and I'm going to call these degrees of freedom qubits, quantum bits, for the moment, just because so I can say qubits instead of degrees of freedom. So they interact on a few qubits at a time. 2, 10, 12, it doesn't matter, all right? And what you want to do is you want to exponentiate this Hamiltonian. So you want to take e to the minus iht acting on some initial state. You want to find out what happens when you have a physical system starting out in some state, psi, it evolves in time. You want to figure out what happens to it. This is very, very hard classically. Exponentially hard. Number, if you have n qubits, the problem goes as 2 to the 2n. Very hard to do it, okay? So quantum mechanically, it's not so hard. Why is that? Well, first, let's start out with, let me get rid of this junk right here. Let's first start out with evolving things, not for some huge, big, long time, but just for some little tiny piece of time, delta t. Let's evolve it for just some tiny little chunk of time, delta t. So let's actually look to begin with at e to the minus I, let's put it up here, e to the minus I, h delta t. Well, delta t is a little tiny piece of time. So this is equal to e to the minus I h1 plus dot 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 plus h sub m, all these little local Hamiltonians times delta t. And this in turn is equal to, because delta t is small, it's equal to the same thing as first applying h1 for time delta t, then applying h2 for time delta t, and then applying hm for time delta t. And then we have plus order e delta t squared, e delta t quantity squared, where e is kind of the upper bound for the energy, maximum energy. So I'll just call it e max. Let's do that. Maximum energy. This is easy to prove, okay? It's just a Trotter formula, all right? And similarly, e to the minus h t, where t is equal to n, capital N, times delta t, is just equal to, well, this is really easy. This is just equal to e to the minus h delta t times e to the minus I h delta t dot 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 e to the minus I h delta t n times. So these two things, if I take this thing right here, is approximately e to the minus I h delta t. So now if I can just perform this simple transformation on a few qubits, then I can put together lots of these, and by slicing time very thinly, I can, and then repeating many times, I can approximate in n times m steps on a quantum computer, can enact, if you like, e to the minus I ht. But this is easy, because e to the minus I h sub l delta t is a transformation on it's a unitary transformation on a few qubits. And we know how to do simple transformations on a few qubits. It's very hard for n big, but for n small, you can get them as close as you like. Okay? So you can perform simple transformations on a few qubits at a time, all right? And then you can build this up to simulate any local quantum system that you desire. Any local quantum system to any desired degree of accuracy. As an example, let's look at a simple quantum state system. Suppose that I have a Heisenberg model. This is why I introduced that Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So my Hamiltonian is just this swap Hamiltonian, this Heisenberg interaction between spins in a chain. So each of these is coupled by a Heisenberg interaction, S12 for the first one, plus S23, plus dot, 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 plus Sn minus 1n. Okay. Suppose I want to simulate this Hamiltonian. Well, it's not hard at all to simulate this Hamiltonian. I noticed that this isn't, well, I guess I can't move this. I'll write this under here. It's simple. I just take in whatever my initial state is. Let's say that's all in the state 0 to begin with. Well, let's say there's 0, 1, 1. 0, et cetera, because the state 0, 0, 0, 0 is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, so nothing interesting happens to it. And then I just perform these little quantum logic operations on them, 2 by 2. So this is a circuit, a quantum circuit, where u here is just equal to e to the minus s delta t. So I just infinitesimally evolve forward the local Hamiltonian, the local Heisenberg operator, and then I get the full dynamics of this Heisenberg system. And if you don't think that the dynamics of Heisenberg spin change is interesting, then, well, actually, you might have been to these conferences where people talk for the entire conference on the dynamics of Heisenberg spin change and become so disgusted that you don't think that it's interesting any longer. However, this kind of thing is a topic of great interest. So point number one, and this is the practical point, if you can build even a simple quantum computer, you can actually simulate almost any, basically any local quantum system. This could be an extremely useful thing to have around. Because actually, if you look, speaking as an engineer, not that I'm much of an engineer, a quantum mechanical engineer, speaking as a quantum mechanical engineer, that I am, all right, if you look at the kinds of engineering problems that are out there, many of them involve things like, how can Intel prevent an electron in a nanowire from tunneling out of it and tunneling through a transistor that's not supposed to tunnel through, right? Or tunneling through a barrier, an insulating barrier. How can you prevent that from happening? That's very hard to solve. And something like this would make it much more easy to solve, because you could simulate that electron tunneling through this barrier. All right? In fact, there's a whole company called D-Wave, which is, is it in Vancouver, or is it in, anybody, do we know that? Vancouver? Is D-Wave in Vancouver? Yeah, it's in Vancouver. And its whole mission is to build little quantum computers and then sell these simulations to places like Intel. Now, and it's been around for 5 years. It's amazing that it hasn't gone bankrupt. I'm really stunned. I question their business model. But the basic idea is good, whether they are going to be able to do it, you know, in time enough to pay back their venture capital or not. All right. Okay. So everybody happy with this? This is quantum simulation. How are we doing for time? Oh, we're okay. Okay, so now so that's the end of the practical part, although it wasn't too dull. But it's very useful, and let me just point this out for, in terms of for the people from the emergence workshop. This morning, we heard some very nice talks about how you could get behavior of things like quantum field theory and the standard model to emerge from local systems like lattice systems. All right? So any local system such as the lattice systems we were hearing about this morning, which were very beautiful. I mean, Professor Wen gave an incredible talk about how you get fermions out of three-dimensional lattice systems. It was mind-blowing. Well, these kinds of things can clearly be reproduced by these quantum computers. Okay? And in the second half of this talk, I'm going to tell you how, if you have some theory that's based on underlying discrete processes like quantum computation, how you can get a theory of quantum gravity that's based on that. Okay? But before I do that, let me just give the answer to Laplace's demon. I would calculate it for you, but you know what? It's easy. This is an easy calculation. It's in this paper right here, but I don't want to run through it. I want to tell you more about quantum gravity. So if it could do 10 to the 120 ops on 10 to the 90 bits, then it could simulate the universe, okay, up to this point. So within the horizon, so within what we can see over the last age of the universe, which now I'm told is 13.8 billion years. How do I get that? I just look at basically, you know, whatever the local Hamiltonian of the universe is, I ask how much energy there is, how far do I have to evolve in time in these little time steps? And you find basically, if you're talking about flipping the bits in your quantum computer has to flip 10 to the 120 bits. And there are 10 to the 120, it has to flip bits 10 to the 120 times, 10 to the 90 bits, 10 to the 120 times. All right? Of course, if you ask how vast this intellect, quote, intellect of this quantum computer would be, quite naturally, you would find that the smallest quantum computer that could do that would be the size of the universe as itself. Right? Not surprising, because this quantum computer has to devote one degree of freedom to every degree of freedom in the universe. And the universe is already damn crammed with degrees of freedom. I mean, it's very close to its critical density. In fact, most people think it is at its critical density. And if it's at its critical density, you can't cram any more degrees of freedom into the universe. So Laplace's demon is okay as it goes, but in fact, it's in some sense indistinguishable from the universe itself. The most efficient Laplace's demon that calculates how the universe behaves would actually be something that was going through the same dynamics as the universe itself. So we may actually be not only surrounded by, but part of Laplace's demon. Okay? That's the philosophy part of the talk. Yes? Right. I mean, there's a certain, so the way you derive this is you go to the fundamental physics of computation, and there are limits on how fast you can flip a bit, given how much energy you have. It's a rather simple derivation, actually, right? We only have a certain amount of energy in the universe, all right, if the universe is at its critical density. And you just suppose, you just assume that all that energy has been used since the Big Bang, just churning away, flipping bits like mad in order to simulate, you know, the universe. Of course, what that computer looks like is indistinguishable from the universe. All that energy has been out there. It's been churning away like mad, interacting in a pairwise fashion, just like this, constructing the universe, all right? So they're not distinguishable from each other, the simulation of the universe and the universe. Laplace's demon is the universe. Yeah? Yeah. So let me erase the board as I do this so I can tell you how you actually make a theory of the universe as a computer. But so since I'm going to tell you a theory, this is about half of a theory of the universe as a computer, because basically what I've said showed to you is that it is in fact it's straightforward to reproduce something like the standard model on a quantum computer. You know, lattice gauge theory, the Hamiltonian is of this form, right? And so its dynamics can be reproduced on a quantum computer. So the first good thing about a computational theory of the universe is that we actually know how to reproduce something like the Standard Model. Of course, we know how to reproduce other things as well, right? So it doesn't tell us that it's just the Standard Model. It could reproduce other things also. But you know, you at least want to be able to reproduce the Standard Model. And in this, of course, we're in kind of the same boat as string theory in the sense that, you know, if we have this string theory, famous landscape with all these humongous number of Calabi-Yau manifolds, any one of which could be the Standard Model, right? We're actually in better shape here because we only, if you'll see, the set of simple quantum computations is rather small. So the first thing is that it's good. It's a good theory in that we can reproduce the dynamics. And you know, that's good as a theory of everything goes. But you know, may I say I hate the words for theory of everything? This I call a potential theory of everything. Because theories of everything are typically theories of nothing, right? You know, that's my main beef with them. So this is kind of a research project, a potential theory of everything, or a PTOE, which is what I think of theories of everything when I say PTOE, right? Sorry, excuse me. So I don't mean to spit on theories of everything. It's just, you know, they're only as good as they are for what you can use them for. There is one thing that this picture of universe as quantum computer gives you that ordinary physical theories do not. And I should say that, you know, thinking of the universe as some computational system and thinking of it in terms of the Standard Model are completely compatible with each other. It's not like one or the other. They can both go along together. But if you recognize the computational ability of the universe at bottom, it does explain something about the universe, which is quite important, and that's its complexity, right? If you take a computer and you program it at random, what do you think you get? Well, garbage, typically, right? Garbage in, garbage out, all right? But this is very different from the famous example of a whole bunch of monkeys typing onto typewriters and just producing a whole bunch of garbage. If you put a bunch of random programs into a computer and you look at what comes out, you find out most of the time it's garbage. But a large fraction of the time something interesting happens. Why? Because there are short programs that will produce almost anything interesting. You know, some fraction of the time some piece of this computer starts computing away the first billion digits of pi, right? One piece of it starts doing geometry. Since there are very short programs that allow computers to start proving all possible theorems, another part of this computer is starting to prove all possible theorems in some canonical order, right? In other words, if the universe is computationally capable, this explains why it's complex, all right? And that's nothing to sneeze at. Mind you, there are a bunch of details to fill in there, and that's what biologists are trying to do, right? How did life originate? Exactly what were these original computations the universe was doing to make it complex? Okay? But it does give you something that an ordinary theory of everything does not, this computational theory. Okay, let me go on to quantum gravity from quantum computation, because I don't have much time. And this is going to be the last time I talked about this here, and by the way, I've made some improvements in this if you went to my last talk here last spring, I guess it was. The talk lasted for 3 hours. I can assure you that's not going to happen now. And it wasn't my fault either. I kept trying to stop. Okay, so quantum gravity from quantum computation. Now, what is the basic idea? The idea is, just as I gave you a way of reproducing the dynamics of any local quantum system, such as a quantum field theory, via a quantum computation, we now want to derive an idea of gravity from some underlying quantum computation. So normally, now, quantum gravity, as people here know better than anybody else, is a very, very hard topic. All right? It's really hard to do. Quantizing gravity is one of the hardest things that people have actually ever tried to do. There are way too many degrees of freedom. It's very hard to start with classical general relativity and quantize it. So I'm not even going to do that. I'm not even going to buy. I learn from other people's pain and suffering. And I don't like pain and suffering that much myself. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to say, I'm going to start with a quantum theory and derive gravity from that. I'm just going to guess a quantum theory. Okay? And then I'm going to see, does it give something like gravity? Well, so we guess an underlying quantum theory. So we guess a quantum theory. And then we see if we can derive gravity from that. This is the virtue that we don't have to quantize anything. This theory is already quantized. And indeed, the quantum theory, of course, you won't be surprised, is quantum computation. Or more accurately, I think that if you don't like quantum computation, and for some reason some people have a visceral reaction against quantum computation, I don't know why, but I understand that, it's okay. I have a visceral reaction against theories of everything, okay? If you don't like quantum computation, think of this as a discrete quantum theory with pairwise interactions. Discrete quantum mechanics with pairwise interactions, because that's all quantum computation is, right? So this is our quantum theory. It's a quantum computation. It's discrete quantum mechanics with pairwise interactions, which I just showed you how it works, right? Okay, because it's just quantum computation. And now I'm going to try to derive something like gravity from this. So what's the idea? We start with a quantum computation. I'll draw up another quantum computation that I had before. Here's the one that I had before. It's a very simple-looking quantum computation simply because I am too lazy to draw too many more quantum logic gates. And can we get, the question is, can we get an idea of space-time, or as we'll see, it will be a superposition of space-time, from this quantum computation, from the quantum computation. And it should obey the Einstein's equation, or something like the Einstein equation, should obey the Einstein equations in some limit, in a suitable limit. Okay, now, the answer is yes, okay? So, and I'm not claiming this is the right way to derive a quantum theory of gravity from a quantum computation, but it is a self-consistent way of deriving a quantum theory of gravity from quantum computation. Now let me say that, first of all, this looks quite different from an ordinary theory of space-time. Space-time is supposed to be, you know, a continuous theory. It's a geometric theory, right? Space-time, Einstein's equations are equations that relate the presence of matter to curvature. And none of that appears to be here, at least at first glance. However, let's look what we have here, okay? What do we have in a quantum computation? So we have initial and final quantum states. So let's look what structure is there. And I would like to argue to you, I won't have time to derive this in detail because I only have 10 minutes left here. And I refuse to go on for 3 hours because I want to hear the concert. All right. But let me try to make plausible to you how this works, and I'm going to be here for the next few days, and also you can look in gory detail on at this paper on quantum pH, which tells you in gory detail just how one does this. But let me describe this qualitatively. So what do you have in this quantum computation? You have initial final states. Now, here's something that's important. You have a causal structure, this wiring diagram, right? The wires tell you where information flows. Having a causal structure is extremely important. Space-time has a causal structure, right? And in fact, when I first started working on something like this, not this particular theory, but an attempt to derive quantum gravity from an underlying quantum system, it was when I was actually taking this graduate seminar with Stephen Hawking. You were there, I think. It was in 1984 or something like that, with Stephen Hawking's graduate seminar. And he pointed out, he could still talk in those days, he pointed out this, what was apparently a well-known fact, that if you know the causal structure of space-time, that is to say the light cone structure, that determines the entire metric of space-time up to a length scale at each point, up to a conformal factor. So having a causal structure is actually good. That's in fact, that could be almost enough. But there's more. We have more information. We also have dynamics, right? So we have local dynamics. And these are the gates. All right? So in fact, it looks like, now that I've revealed to you this well-known fact, right, reminded you of this well-known fact, that once you know the causal structure of a space-time and you know a local length scale, then you actually have the metric fixed, you can see that this is not so, perhaps not so implausible as you might think, trying to derive a notion of gravity or a metric, some kind of metric, from a quantum computation. Indeed, we have this causal structure. We're missing information about the local length scale, but local length scales can be extracted from the local dynamics in a self-consistent fashion. And let me remind you how this is normally done, because we actually have a great example of this that is in existence. It was originally due to Einstein, of course, but it's called, I mean, not built by Einstein, but the idea was presented by Einstein. It's called GPS, right? And in GPS, you've got a bunch of clocks that are moving through space, okay? They're ticking as they go. They're sending out signals to each other. And by measuring the time of departure and the time of arrival of these signals and comparing them with the local ticks of the clocks, you can reproduce or can reconstruct a discretized, because of course it doesn't give you information for the small scales, a discretized version of space-time, or of the space-time metric. I mean, it's not some kind of fiction. This is happening above our heads, even as we're talking, right? This is exactly how GPS works. And you can see that these actually are rather similar. We have signals moving back and forth. These are like these wires in this computation. We have ticks of clocks, bits flipping. These are like these local transformations here. They differ in detail, right? Because we don't have clocks here yet. We have quantum bits. We have quantum logic operations. But we can imagine that if we have a quantum computation, okay, we have a quantum computation that we might be able to do some similar kind of thing with a quantum computation. That is to say, reconstruct the metric of space-time from what's happening to the quantum matter underneath. All right? Now, and I'm not doing fine in terms of giving you all the details of this, but that's okay. I'm doing fine in terms of being able to tell you how this works. So let me tell you how this works. Let's actually compare what one does in GPS. So let's first start with GPS, and then we'll see what happens. So how does GPS work? I found out that I've written a bunch of papers now on quantum versions of GPS and the quantum mechanical limits to GPS, and I found out that I had been become an expert on GPS because a reporter from the Boston Globe called me up and said, Professor Lloyd, would you care to comment on use of GPS to tag sex offenders? And I said, oh, I'm so sorry, it's out of my area of expertise. This stuff about GPS was in Nature plus Scientific American last in November of 1994, if you want to look at these things. Okay, so what do you do? In GPS, what do you do? Well, you take the information you have, the data about when the clocks are ticking and when the signals are arriving and departing, and then you try to reconstruct a self-consistent picture of space-time. Basically, you try to say, okay, I know when the signal got left here, I know when it got there, I know when it got there. What's the distance of this line right here? Right? What's the length of this space-like line right here? This is how Einstein clock synchronization works, right? This was due to Einstein. What's the length of this line right here? Okay, let's make some more, I don't need to make some more clocks, okay? So Well, how does a self-consistency work? What do you assume? Self-consistency works by assuming that general relativity is true. You assume that light travels along null geodesics, okay? You assume that clocks travel along time like geodesics, and that the proper time, the number of ticks that they make is proportional to the proper time along those geodesics, okay? You basically are assuming that general relativity holds, and you use the Einstein equations and general relativity as constraints to resolve your data, and you assign this length, assign so that general relativity is correct, right? You assume that general relativity is correct, and then you use that information to make these measurements. Of course, it would be possible, in principle, for you to assume that general relativity was correct, and you find there's no way to actually assign these lengths so that it's true. But in fact, since general relativity is correct at a macroscopic scale, when you try to reconstruct the geometry of space-time from GPS data, you find, indeed, it matches. And of course, you have to use general relativity for things like the Sagnac effect in order to make sense out of GPS data. Right? You have to include it. GPS is the place in ordinary life where general relativity intervenes in the most alarming and direct fashion. Okay. So over here, what do you do? Well, these wires correspond to places that bits move. Nothing happens to bits as they move along these wires. A bit that starts out pointing up is pointing up at the end. A bit that's pointing down, or 0 or 1, is 0 or 1 at the end. Okay? It's the same. Nothing happens. That means the action along these lines is 0. If the action is 0, we identify these with time, with light-like or null lines. Okay. Now, an interesting feature arises, and for the emergence people, I should point this out. So far in this computation, nothing that I've said about the computation says that it ought to be in four dimensions. All right, I could easily make some kind of funky quantum computation that's infinite dimensional. However, once I start identifying pieces of the computation with pieces of my spacetime, in particular, once I identify these ingoing and outgoing wires with null lines of the spacetime, I find that my construction will only work in four dimensions. Why? Well, I have four null lines at each point, and they're typically going to be linearly independent of each other. This means that in fewer than four dimensions, I cannot define four linearly independent null lines. Okay? And in more than four dimensions, what one finds when one does this reconstruction is that there's not enough data to reconstruct the metric. So exactly because these are pairwise interactions between, let me put this up over here. Because these are pairwise interactions between quantum degrees of freedom, so pairwise interactions implies locally four-dimensional. For instance, if I just take some event, right, and its neighboring events, I try to make a discretized version of spacetime. So I try to figure out the lengths, for instance, of all these local lines right here. Then those in the know, like David Finkelstein, who is sitting right there looking at this, know that this is a four simplex. Or a pentahedron, right? Is that what you call that? A pentahedron. Pentahedron. Four simplex or pentahedron. So, over here, in the case of this computational universe picture, what you do is you locally connect gates to each other. So here are the steps. Let me write them out. And then I'll stop, because I can't actually go and derive all of these steps. So they're done in gory detail in these papers. So the steps are as follows. So extend. So the first step is to extend the what I call the computational history. or the computational lattice, if you like. You extend it to a simplicial lattice. So a lattice made up of four simplices by adding edges. Now, when I came here last time, I had one way of doing this. And then I developed a whole bunch of other ways of doing this. And then I've made the mistake of actually going to the literature and actually reading books about how to construct simplicial lattices, which was it wasn't a mistake, but it was very painful. And then I realized that there are lots of different ways to do this. So there are lots of ways to do this. And what's the message is, you can do it any way you want. It won't matter. It will correspond to the same space-time. The reason is simple. This is a triangulation of a space-time. Think of a surveyor triangulating a landscape. A surveyor comes along and triangulates the landscape, divides it up into little triangles, calculates the distances and the curvature at each point, and says, aha, here's what the landscape looks like, and here's the curvature. Another surveyor comes along, triangulates the landscape in a completely different fashion, divides it up into little triangles, calculates the angles, calculates the distance, and says, aha, here's the curvature in this region. They agree, up to some, you know, factors that depend upon the local variation, things that they've missed. Here, no matter how you triangulate this, it will have the same causal structure and the same local dynamics. And that will end up giving you the same local curvature. Okay? So I've agonized a lot over this, about the fact that there seem to be many ways of doing this, but now I think it doesn't really matter. Because these lines are just fictions anyway. Just like in GPS. This is not some dynamical piece of your system, it's just something you're inferring from the underlying dynamics of the system. So that's step one. Step two is, okay, once you have a simplicial lattice, now if you assign edge lengths, the system is rigid, okay? You've assigned a whole discrete geometry, a Regi calculus. So you simply assign edge lengths, just as in GPS, assuming the Einstein Regi equations hold. Let me write it out. Here, so in this picture, Einstein Regi equations are a constraint or a method for extrapolating your known information, the observable information. What is your observable information here? It's where information goes and what happens in these logic gates. That is the only observable information here. You extrapolate from your observable information to try to derive what the lengths of all these other, you know, fictitious lines are. So the self-consistent way is to do it just the way you do it in GPS. You assume general relativity holds, and now you try to assign those lines to make Einstein Regi equations hold. Now here you could be completely screwed, right? Because at this point, you know, just in the same way that general relativity could prove to be wrong, if it were not right, you wouldn't get this. This wouldn't work. But in fact, what you find is that there are exactly the correct number of degrees of freedom to make the Einstein-Regi equations hold, but this is, of course, with matter. And let me tell you what the degrees of freedom are. You know, because these lines are null, you know 4 out of 10 components of the metric. You're missing 6 components of the metric. But you also have this stuff that's zooming around, this kind of computational matter. You also don't know what the energies and momenta are of these guys going along these lines. You do know the local energy in the logic gates, because you know the dynamics in the logic gates. It turns out that this is exactly the right amount of the number of parameters that to allow you to make the Einstein-Regi equations hold. And it actually wouldn't work in other than 4 dimensions. So, well, then you're done. Okay, I think these are only 2 steps. Okay. So, and if you go through my paper, there's all sorts of garbage in it. It looks kind of complicated. But in fact, all that it's really doing is just taking papers that Regi and other people have written and saying, and ideas from GPS and saying, OK, start from this, using the ideas from GPS, get to this, reconstruct a metric according to that is self-consistent. And what you find is that you can, for any quantum computation, you can get a space-time locally four-dimensional in which the Einstein-Grege equations hold. Okay, so that's the main result. Now, let me actually raise a whole bunch of questions, because it's time for me to stop, I believe, right? First thing, of course, as Renata Lull pointed out, which is very important, just because the Einstein-Grege equations hold at the, sorry, just because a system is four-dimensional at its smallest level, so it's made out of these four simplices, so you have Grege calculus that's microscopically four-dimensional, doesn't mean it's macroscopically four-dimensional. This computation could wiggle all over the place. So it's an open question as to whether this kind of system actually gives you something like the universe that we see. Now, when I've done preliminary calculations using kind of cellular automaton-like architectures, regular architectures, you find actually the whole thing just it remains spherically symmetric, it expands, it looks pretty normal. It gives an initial period of inflation, et cetera. But I think that one has to go into the details of actually simulating this, deriving the Einstein-Grege equations, finding out what these edge lengths are for typical kinds of systems to see if this works. The biggest issue here, which Fortini raised when I came here last, and I'll use her words, is what is the mother computation, right? This is any computation. This is too profligate. It's like, you know, it's like the landscape in string theory. There's too much, it's too rich, an embarrassment of riches. By the way, my secret, it's not a secret, well, no, my secret feeling about string theory is the reason it's such a beautiful and rich theory is because it, of course, is computationally universal. So you can derive virtually any mathematical structure from it, right? I mean, it's good. Being computationally universal is good, okay? So we don't know what is the mother computation. We're not doing really a sum over computations. Though, in fact, if you look inside this, you'll find that there's a kind of an implicit sum over computations here. What should our underlying theory to get the standard model be? How are we getting the standard model? Well, remember, the things like lattice gauge theory come because we identify what's going through these wires with matter. We're reproducing that behavior from matter. Well, I was about to embark on some quixotic research project to say how we should do it, but then after Professor Wen's talk today, he had a beautiful example of a local lattice model that contains, you know, that potentially contains the standard model. And that local lattice model that Professor Wen was talking about today could in a very straightforward fashion, be put into this kind of situation, this kind of framework. Raphael Sorkin and Faye Dauke pointed out to me that we still have to worry about things like local Lorentz invariants in the system. Despite the fact that I've carefully avoided all these problems with actually quantizing gravity, as opposed to taking a quantum theory and deriving gravity from it, there's still lots of open questions here. But at any rate, it's got the feature that, you know, because quantum computation is powerful, in the way that string theory is powerful, it's powerful, and that means that you can reproduce things like the standard model. And because we know how to take things like quantum systems that are zooming around, sending signals back and forth, and to take that information and parlay it into information about lengths and distances, we know at least one way, and there may be many more, and Fortini was talking about potential other ones today. And I should say that Fortini has been working on, and Olaf have been working on things like this long before I was, so, okay. We know how to derive ideas of geometry from an underlying quantum dynamics. And it is possible at least one way to do so in a way that is consistent with the Einstein equations. So, anyway, it's a fun and no doubt quixotic project, but I hope at least I've convinced you that there might be something not only for philosophers or applied mathematicians or quantum information theory or quantum gravity people to work on. And thank you very much for your patience.
Okay, thank you, Seth, for a very beautiful talk. We have some questions.
There is a word suitable limit. What does it mean? What does it involve?
Yeah, well, you're very right, of course, to say that anytime somebody says a suitable limit, they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes, right? Yeah, I don't know what a suitable limit is. So normally, as in these talks about emergence, one wants to say, suppose that one takes a coarse-grained picture of the system. So one, say, averages over volumes of spacetime that contain many points. And I should, by the way, I should mention that the distance between these points is not the Planck length, in case you were thinking it was. This, remember the number of ops in the universe? 10 to the 120 ops in the universe? That means that the average distance between these guys is on the order of tens of microns or something like that. And they're closer together here on Earth, where matter is closer together, and further apart out in interstellar space. Indeed, out in interstellar space, there's just the cosmic microwave body. So it's cosmic background radiation. And that only resolves space-time to about, you know, that size. So a suitable limit would be coarse grain over volumes, coarse grain the energy momentum tensor. Then you can get a quasi-continuum picture of Einstein's equations. And you'd have to ensure that things were smooth enough on that scale, and that they then actually did indeed, the systems that actually came out of it upon coarse graining actually did give you Einstein's equations. So if they went all crazy, like some of the systems that Renata Lowell was talking about, then that wouldn't work.
Do I understand? And the microphone back.
Shout it out.
So you claim that with your, in your framework, somehow it forces things to be four-dimensional, at least locally. And I'm confused about that, because the diagram you drew over there, it looks like it's two dimensions, one dimension in space and one dimension in time. And there's something I'm not getting about this. Could you explain?
Well, you are viewing the projection onto 1 + 1 dimensions of something that's 1 + 3 dimensional, okay? That's the simple answer. Actually, of course, you know, I played around with things with other dimensions, you know. I'd be foolish not to. Other dimensions are so popular these days. And I started with things that were two-dimensional. And you can actually try to do this in two dimensions. But it doesn't work so well. I mean, in two dimensions, these are supposed to be scattering events, right? The only way for this to work in two dimensions is if there's no deflection of these particles as they go through these scattering events. And that's a kind of weird scattering event. The two-dimensional theories I got from it were all seem to be kind of trivial. So, and in four dimensions, I didn't force it to be four-dimensional. I was just trying to reconstruct it, right? And the thing is that you have this geometric content from having these, the fact that these lines are null comes from the fact that their action is zero, right? So there's no zero proper time along them. And then you have four null lines at each point. When you embed this in some space-time, that gives you four independent null lines. It's hard to get around that. I couldn't get around it. I tried other ways, and there may indeed be other ways to make this in higher dimensions. So I'm afraid that's not a very good answer. It just seems to work well. It looks four-dimensional at the microscale, and it works out. If you can solve the Einstein-Greggy equations in four dimensions. And it didn't work in fewer dimensions. And there wasn't enough information in more dimensions.
Okay.
So that's not saying it couldn't be.
Could you pass the microphone back and then across?
So this metric that you reconstruct from the quantum circuit you drew there, is it a classical one, or is it a superposition of some states, states?
Right. So actually, that's a really good question. So in fact, I did kind of, I debated actually going through this, but since you give me the, allow me to do this. Remember how I had my quantum logic, my swap quantum logic gate? It looked something like this. There was something that projected onto the singlet state, right, which had zero energy, and there was no scattering, right? Nothing happens. No phase gets accumulated. And then I had something where there was scattering, where there was a phase that was accumulated. I kind of sloughed over this for lack of time, but really something like this is a superposition, a coherent two superposition of a no scattering event plus some scattering kind of event. So, okay? So actually, the way that I've been working on this, this does not represent one causal structure. There are many possible causal, 2 to the n causal structures, where n is the number of gates. Now, everything, and this represents, there's one for every, let's see, okay, there's basically, this is the observable content of the theory. If I imagine making local measurements of the energy, I get either energy 1 or energy 0. Okay, they're 2 to the n possibilities. And they're 2 to the n different causal structures, one for each of those. So I imagine the complete set of eigenstates that I could measure. There are 2 to the n of these. Each one of those 2 to the n systems gets a classical geometry. Okay? So the reconstruction of the geometry, once I know what the causal structure is, what the local action is, that is completely classical and shamelessly steals from Reggie and from GPS. Okay? Because it's much easier than trying to rederive it if it's already been derived. So the reconstruction of the geometry from the quantum stuff is classical. But because of these quantum fluctuations, right, quantum fluctuations in the causal structure and these angles, quantum fluctuations in the action, then there are also fluctuations in the curvature as well. So does that help?
Yes, thank you.
OK, if you could pass the microphone over there.
Actually, my question is related. So now I can ask a further one. Suppose if you fix the theta equal to some particular value, like a pi.
Fix the what time? I'm sorry?
The theta you have there.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
If you choose theta equal to pi or 0,
yeah.
Do you get some particular universe or, how the definition model affect your output,
Yeah, so that's a good question. So remember that to reproduce, if you look at the ways of reproducing things like lattice gauge theories in a discretized context, these thetas were all small, right? They were all small. And if you look at, there are quite a few papers out there that tell you how to get things like the Dirac equation or the Maxwell's equations or equation for a scalar field by putting them on a lattice. And they typically these what happens here is just for small theta. It would be very interesting to see. I mean, of course, I would love it to be like big theta. Why not? It doesn't really matter. One way to think of it is that we work in a limit where these thetas are small. Which, oh, by the way, that's also the limit in which Reggie calculus gives the theta here corresponds to the curvature also, right? And so Reggie calculus only gives you Einstein's equations on the limit of small local curvatures. So the limit in which I know that this gives you something like, Einstein equations, at least from the Reggie part, is for small theta. But it would be very interesting to have it be large discrete theta as well. But I don't know if that would actually correspond to things like the standard model.
Okay, Vikar?
So this is just a follow-up.
Yeah.
Professor Wen asked about the output. What's the input?
Ah, yeah. So I didn't tell you what this does for you. So if you there's lots of course, being a PTOE, it gives potential solutions for lots of problems. Okay? And what I assume, so in the version that I typically use, I use a kind of a, in fact, my history of this was I started out reading all these beautiful papers by Lee and Carlo Rovelli about loop quantum gravity. And I said, this is so beautiful and discrete. There's got to be a quantum computation version of this, right? And then as it got more accurate, I couldn't figure out how to make a quantum computation version of it, except in the way that Fortini was talking about today, about each of these spin-foam interactions is some set of logic gates. But I did make I did start out by making a spin network picture of quantum computation. So my picture is you create states in singlets. This is a singlet, okay? This is equal to just in the ordinary spin network picture, it's I 0, 1, minus 1, 0. It's an unnormalized singlet. Then these gates are just swaps, e to the minus s. So but s is normally, one of these swap operators in spin network picture. And then you can also have single qubit transformations, which are like e to the minus I theta sigma. And then when you do this, these are the basic pictures of from SU2 operations that Penrose firstly came up with for spin networks. You get a very nice, well, to my mind, very nice. You may find it kind of boring, but you get a nice picture of how quantum computation in terms of these spin networks. So inputs are singlets. And outputs, of course, are also singlets. So it just says in this picture, that things can only be created or annihilated in singlets, okay? Which is what happens, for instance, in Professor Wen's models there. This has, let me show you, but just because you asked, let me show you how black hole evaporation works here. This is quite funny. This is, by the way, not my model originally. This is by Gary Horowitz and Juan Maldacena. And a lot more work has been done by other people like John Preskill and Daniel Gottesman. So what does a black hole look like? A black hole looks very normal. Somebody falling into the black hole, okay? Somebody falling in the black hole, you know, their clocks are ticking, everything's fine, but things have gotten very dense in there, and it turns out that horizon has been created. Okay? They don't know it necessarily. They haven't figured out that there's a horizon there, right? As in, if it's a huge black hole, that might be the case. But eventually, they get close to the singularity. And what's a singularity? A singularity is a place where space-time goes away. And where does space-time go away? Well, in this picture, space-time goes away and comes into existence by forming these singlets and goes away by forming these singlets. Okay? So, they go in here, wham, they hit the singularity. Ouch, that's gotta hurt, right? However, where did the other part of these singlets come from? Well, you know, on the outside of the black hole, there's this Hawking radiation where all the stuff is being created as singlets, right? Half of the singlets fall in the black hole. Now if, and this of course is a big if, I mean it's quite speculative, if the stuff that falls, that hits the singularity, if it only interacts with this other half of these singlets from the Hawking radiation, okay? And if you ask what state goes on here, and here's, you know, it's transformed state, it's like, la-di-da-di-da, everything's fine. It's like, whoa, man, that's a big singularity coming up, right? Like, oh, gosh, darn. And here it's like squish, okay? And you ask what state comes out here, the answer is the state u times psi. It's like, whoa, what happened? Oh, man, I just saw this big singularity coming up. Oh, now I'm outside this black hole, all right? So in fact, if you there are fun pictures. The answer to your question brings up fun pictures about how bits of space-time get created and how they go away in the end, and also gives you pictures of what happens during black hole evaporation. And there are other versions of, by the way, this also gives you pictures of the back reaction, et cetera, all the normal things that people want to find out with. But I thought I'd share with you black hole evaporation because it's kind of fun.
It's not working. Any more questions? One
Achim,
quick
Achim has one.
What?
Achim has one.
One, yes. Last question, Achim.
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't that be terribly non-local from the singularity to the horizon?
This kind of effect, as if you read the commentaries on this Horowitz and Maldacena mechanism, this is a very bad thing to have had. This kind of thing is very bad. That's why I'm very suspicious of it. Okay, but it's actually, you know, it's one of those things. If you go through the mathematics, that's what happens. The problem with it is that if things get created and go away just as singlets, and you end up projecting onto that state, that's a kind of nonlinear process. So this is clearly something very bad is going on. Otherwise, you know, something really bad has to happen for you to escape from a black hole. So I don't take this necessarily too seriously. However, it's important to go and work out the mathematics to see what happens. And when you work out the mathematics to see what happens, this is what happens, you get out. Right? And the other thing is that because there's a black hole there, it also doesn't involve, it involves getting out of the black hole, but you can't do things like go back and kill your grandfather and this kind of thing. It doesn't involve time travel paradox. So any theory about escape from black holes is speculative to the max. Don't jump into one right now. That's my advice to you. It's too early.
Okay. I'm tempted to use my prerogative as chair to say, what's wrong with just bouncing singularity and keep running? Your quantum computer doesn't have to crash. Yep. It could keep running.
That could easily be right. You could certainly have a bunch of things going into like some big crunch and then coming out, right? And that's quite possible in this. That's also okay. Yeah. I mean, I think the drawback of this whole approach is that it's almost too flexible. I mean, it's the good part is that it's self-consistent, right? And it gives you a picture of what's going on. But, you know, because quantum computation is a very flexible process, you can reproduce what you desire with it to some degree. So I think in order to make this really into, you know, a real theory of everything as opposed to a potential theory of everything, you have to make some guess or make some arguments about just what is the matter, you know, what is the computation that's going on.
Very good. On that note, we close the first colloquium joint with Wilfrid Laurier, and we look forward to the next one. And we close the day of the Emergence Conference, and we thank Seth for a very inspiring talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bring it.